Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 111, or as J.R.R. Tolkien called it, 111, Oh Say Can You See, on the history of organic light-emitting diodes. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. Our previous episode on light-emitting diodes, or LEDs for short, number 99, was all about inorganic materials. Now we shift to a much newer material, the organic LED, that is, made of molecules of carbon. The earliest work leading to organic LEDs, or OLEDs, starts in 1953, when a French team overseen by André Bernanos, working on chemiluminescence of organic compounds, discovered that a dye, acridine orange, when placed on sheets of cellulose, or dissolved into cellulose, would glow when a high voltage was applied across the material. Acridine orange has been used as a cellular dye in biology and fluoresces. Its molecular structure consists of three fused benzene rings, with the center ring containing a nitrogen atom, plus two nitro groups, one hanging off each side ring. The dye molecule, under blue light, fluoresces with slightly different colors, depending on whether it's attached to a DNA or RNA molecule. If you recall the episode in which I talked about fluorescence and alternating single and double bonds, well, these alternating single and double bonds exist in acridine orange. In 1961, the English scientists C.A. Parker and C.G. Hatchard researched the phosphorescence of an organic dye, eosin. Eosin is a molecule made of three hexagonal rings fused together, in which the middle ring has an oxygen atom. There are bromines, or maybe a couple of nitro groups, hanging off, plus a benzoate group. In sum, it's a larger red-colored organic molecule with a long history in biology as a fluorescent compound used to stain cells, and it also has alternating single and double bonds. Parker and Hatchard found phosphorescence in the eosin molecule, meaning that when irradiated with light, an electron in eosin jumps to a higher energy molecular orbital. That excited electron drops to a nearby orbital with a different spin, and can't drop back down to the lowest energy easily. Therefore, the excited electrons in the eosin molecule only occasionally drop back down, giving off photons of light as phosphorescence over a long period of time. A couple of years later, a group led by Martin Pope at New York University observed electroluminescence in the organic molecule anthracene, a molecule of three fused benzene rings. They used tiny crystals, only around 15 micrometers across, and applied a voltage across them to see a visible light in a dimly lit room. You may recall in the earliest work on LEDs that electroluminescence was a required property of materials to make LEDs. By 1965, they noted that the electroluminescence in this molecule comes from electrons and holes combining, which sounds awfully familiar to us in the world of inorganic LEDs. An actual polymer-based LED was invented by Englishman Roger Partridge doing secret government work in the early 1970s. He put a thin layer of poly-N-vinyl carbazole, less than 2.2 micrometers thick, between two electrodes. The resulting glow was visible under normal room lights. His polymer LED was patented in the USA in 1975 by the UK Secretary of State for Industry under the really vague title Radiation Sources, which you can guess that the title could mean anything from X-rays to microwaves. The goal was to make a cheaper version of the existing relatively expensive inorganic gallium phosphide or gallium phosphide aluminide. According to the patent, you start with a glass plate with transparent conductors on it, then add a 1 to 2 micrometer layer of a 4 to 1 mixture of polyvinyl carbazole and antimony pentachloride. This injects electrical holes, the absence of electrons. On top of this, you add a 1 micrometer layer made of a mixture of polyvinyl carbazole plus perylene, a fluorescent organic compound. On top of that, you pour an electrical contact of cesium metal, which melts in your hand but solidifies on the cooler LED. The cesium can also inject electrons into the LED. Partridge's work, owned by the UK government, went unnoticed while the UK tried to get industrial partners to commercialize it and failed. So nothing happened. Full disclosure of his methods wasn't published until 1983. While Partridge's work languished, other research groups pushed forward on organic electroluminescent devices, especially Gareth Roberts at Durham University. By 1982, Roberts put a film of anthracene under 1 micrometer thick onto a substrate material, applied 12 volts across it, and saw blue electroluminescence. Roberts' observations spurred more groups to study electroluminescence using entire polymer chains or at least organic molecules. One Japanese team at Kyushu University were able to make multi-layer optoelectronic devices in the mid-1980s, first with cyanine dyes and then films of perylene. The specific cyanine dye was a complicated organic molecule with 2 wing-like benzene attachments to a central hydrocarbon chain. Cyanines in general have a nitrogen atom within the conjugated part of the chain. The cyanine version glowed a yellow-green color at 570 nanometers output. The overall structure of these devices was a glass plate, upon which was a transparent conductive film of indium tin oxide, which injects holes, then a layer to transport those holes, then the electroluminescent organic layer, then a layer to transport electrons, and a magnesium silver electrode on top to inject the electrons. Recall that an LED works at the junction where the electrons and holes meet. The electrons fall into the holes and emit light. This is why you need the multiple layers to make sure all the parts meet correctly. The downside of the Japanese research group's work was that you needed 50 volts to drive the material to glow, which is quite a lot of voltage, and it only lasted around 5 hours, which is not long enough for commercial purposes. The real kicker was the work of Ching Tang, a Hong Kong-American chemist working at Eastman Kodak from the mid-1970s onward. He had been studying electroluminescent organic devices in the late 1970s. He discovered that tetraphenylene would work. Tetraphenylene is a cool molecular structure, 4 benzene rings in an 8-member carbon ring, and has plenty of conjugated bonding. So what he did was to patent what he called an organic electroluminescent cell in 1980, which used the tetraphenylene mixed with a polymer as a binder, examples of which we've mentioned, including polystyrene, polyester, polyimide, or others. The thickness of this tetraphenylene polymer mixture was less than 1 micrometer. this device was able to operate at only 20 volts with decent intensity. But then he gave up on the polymer binder and reformulated his organic LED and published with chemist Steven van Slyck what is now considered a classic paper in September 1987 in the journal Applied Physics Letters called Organic Electroluminescent Devices. He used first an organic diamine layer only 75 nanometers thick on the glass plus indium tin oxide. The diamine is a quite complicated molecule with benzene-containing wings connected to nitrogen atoms. There are two nitrogen nodes, hence it is a diamine. On top of the diamine layer was the actual luminescent film, only 60 nanometers thick, a metal complex. The name for the compound is 8-hydroxyquinoline aluminum. In the center lies the aluminum atom, and surrounding it are three hydroxyquinoline groups, each connected to the central aluminum by two bonds. On top was the typical magnesium silver alloy electrode. With this setup, they created a true diode which conducts electricity in only one direction. They saw light emission with a very low voltage, as low as 2.5 volts. Light output was green at 550 nanometers, with an efficiency of about 0.5% at 5.5 volts to be visible in room lighting. The output was 1.5 lumens per watt of input power, similar to inorganic LEDs of the day. Tang and van Slyck had invented the first practical organic light-emitting diode, or OLED for short. For a red OLED, Tang, van Slyck, and C.H. Chen published a paper 2 years later, in 1989, by doping the hydroxyquinoline aluminum compound to get an orangey-red color. Chihaya Adachi at Kyushu University achieved the first good blue OLED by 1990. So now we have the possibility of full-color OLED displays with red, green, and blue pixels. As for organic polymer-based LEDs, not much really happened, as we mentioned, after Partridge's research in the early 1970s. Richard Friend, a scientist at Cambridge University, heard of Tang and van Slyck's invention and decided to improve upon it. Instead of smaller molecules as the Eastman-Kodak pair used, which they thought would be unstable over the long term and crystallize, they returned to the polymer idea. Their ideal was a conjugated polymer with the alternating single and double bonds along the main chain of the molecule, rather than bits hanging off the molecule. They realized that commercial fabrication of such a polymer LED would be easy because you can make thin films by spin coating them on a surface. Within 3 years, by 1990, Friend and his team were successful using polyphenylene vinylene as the luminescent material. This glowed green with 15 volts applied across the film. Yes, it worked, but the efficiency was really low, and it only lasted a few days before breaking down. Again, interesting, but not yet commercially viable. Of course, who should get interested in these conductive polymers but Alan Heeger, who had dealt with the inorganic conductive polymers at University of Pennsylvania a decade and a half earlier. Heeger, now at University of California at Santa Barbara, published a paper in 1991 describing an efficiency of about 1%. Their improvement was using polymers dissolved in other organic solvents, but retaining the conjugated bonding in solution. To get around the decay of the device after a few days and to improve the efficiency of electricity conversion to light, scientists finally realized that multiple layers and placing the whole thing into a capsule to keep out water and oxygen was the way to proceed. Over the course of the 1990s, there was continuous improvement in reliability and efficiency of OLEDs, and that's why I put the development of OLEDs at this point in our chemical history. By 1996, the first commercial OLED product was finally ready for prime time. Pioneer, the Japanese electronics company, announced an OLED display for their car audio systems. By 2000, the efficiency was reliably over 1%, lifetimes of some displays were at 10,000 hours, and many colors were available. Blue displays were still a problem, and 1% efficiency was still poor, though. One further aspect of OLEDs I need to address here. And address is a deliberate choice because the address of a specific pixel in an OLED display is the information required to switch it on to glow and switch it off to stop glowing. The organic displays that finally arrived in the late 1990s were what we call passive matrix OLEDs. That means that you switch each pixel on by scanning through the display line by line in a deliberate and cyclic sequence. The display flickers, perhaps noticeably, because you are constantly scanning the entire display panel and switching the pixels on and off. The other choice is what we call active matrix OLED. The active matrix scheme includes an added transistor to switch on a pixel based on its specific address or position in the display panel. The pixel is switched on from its own transistor, and it stays on until you tell the transistor to switch off. As you can guess, with an added transistor at each pixel, such an active matrix display is more complicated and expensive to build. On the other hand, you get clearer, better images with the active matrix method, and the display uses less electric power, which is valuable for portable electronics. So, just around the time that Pioneer was beginning to fabricate its OLED displays for automobile sound systems, the Japanese electronics company TDK demonstrated the first active matrix OLED display. Not until 2002 was the first full-color active matrix OLED display commercially sold in a joint venture between Sanyo Electric Company and Eastman Kodak called SK Display Corporation. We are not yet, though, at our point in our chemical history for an actual wall-mounted TV using OLEDs as the display. True, the SK joint venture did show off a prototype flat-screen OLED monitor with HD resolution in 2002, so we're getting close. Nor are we at the point in our chemical history where OLEDs can be used as a source for room lighting. But in general, why would researchers spend so much time and money on OLEDs when inorganic LEDs already exist? Certainly, in contrast with liquid crystal displays, any LED system is better because you can have thinner and lighter panels. Note also that carbon compounds are generally less dense than inorganic LEDs, so organic versions would be even lighter and better for portable electronics. There is also one more factor driving the OLED research. Can we make flexible displays? Could we make a tablet computer that just rolls up into your coat pocket? How about a roll-up mobile phone? Organic polymers are the natural choice for such display methods. In our next episode, we look at what you might consider a transition form of materials between molecular and macroscopic, the quantum dot. Until then, brave the elements. Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.